Hello and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast updates you with the expertise and current insight of the Washington, D.C.-based attorneys from the Fortney Scott Law Firm. Each episode highlights the most important issues and analysis that employers need to know in order to understand and react to key federal developments affecting their business. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice on any subject matter. Now let's turn it over to our host, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone. David Fortney with another edition of the DC Insider What Employers Need to Know podcast. Really glad to be with everyone and back with two of my partners, Leslie Silverman and John Clifford. Leslie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's so nice to be back.
It's great to have you back. And John, how are things?
I'm doing well, David. I'm excited to be here. Lots of exciting stuff to talk about.
We do have a lot of exciting stuff. And we gave Anita and Bert a little respite for a week or so. But we have a couple of developments here in Washington that I think are really important for employers to know about. And they both are things that are not necessarily on the radar screen. It's not just another regulation or another, you know, we spend so much time talking about a particular enforcement action. Both of these are unique and noteworthy, and we want to make sure that our audience is right on top of these developments. And we're going to spend a little bit of time with our two subject matter experts going over those. We have both a very unusual rulemaking from the Fair Trade Commission, which is a very unusual development to begin with involving employment. And then we have the EEOC pursuing a strategic enforcement plan, which, as I think we're going to learn, is something that doesn't happen every day. So let me start, Leslie, with you. You're the former commissioner and vice chair of the EEOC. Your practice is really focused on watching that agency like a hawk. This strategic enforcement plan that now has been published in the Federal Register, what is it? Can you give us just a little overview? And why is this so significant?
Absolutely, David. So the Strategic Enforcement Plan, or SEP, is a relatively new invention. And I say that having been on the commission before it was invented. It's not actually a statutory requirement, but rather a creation of the 2012 commission. And that commission, under who was then chair, Jacqueline Berrigan, decided to develop this as a 5-year plan, setting forth the agency's top enforcement and litigation priorities. It also is intended to guide other aspects of the commission's duties, such as education, outreach, and guidance. Essentially, the commissioners and the commission publicly declaring to both the commission employees and to the public at large, those specific issues which they are going to focus their attention and resources on. And this is actually the third iteration of the SEP. This draft document will cover the years from 2023 to 2027. Prior to issuing this draft document, the commission held two hearings to obtain input as to what should be included in the plan. And our podcast listeners might recall that, in fact, our moderator, you, David Fortney, testified at that second of those hearings on behalf of the Institute on paid data collection and AI.
I was there. It was a good day and a good proceeding, I thought.
So while this iteration follows the exact same framework as the commission has followed in the past two versions of the document, it's basically six broad bucket categories. While it's supposed to list out those issues of utmost concern to the commission as a way to guide EEOC staff and the public as to what issues should be prioritized, the cumulative effect of adding issues without actually removing others has actually diluted the commission's initial objective of publicizing priorities. In fact, there are few EEO issues that are not actually listed in the current draft SCP.
Leslie, picking up on that point and on my review of the SEP, it certainly seemed to me like the agency had taken the kitchen sink approach to putting this together, throwing everything in there. But my question is, with so much in there, they've really packed it full. Is it still something that's useful to people, to employers specifically? How can they parse through it? And are there any key areas they should focus on?
Yeah, even if this current version is bloated or overstuffed, it's still an incredibly helpful tool for the employer community. because so long as you focus, when you look at the plan and read the plan and maybe read the past plans, but focus on what's new or what's repeatedly emphasized, there's a whole lot they can learn about what will be prioritized in the coming days. And I want to talk about some of those. First of all, for the first time, this plan lists specific industries it intends to prioritize. Two, in fact, the construction and the high-tech industries. And EEOC is not alone here. This is part of a broader Biden administration coordinated effort among agencies who deal with employment issues. And the reason all these agencies have announced they are focusing on these two industries is because the Biden administration views both of these as growth industries who have been the beneficiaries of substantial federal investment through recent legislation. And the government does not believe they've made significant progress in the diversity area. Now, under an established bucket of developing and emerging issues, which by its nature would have to be new, there's also three issues. First, we have a new statute, the recently minted Pregnancy Worker Fairness Act, which was a bipartisan piece of legislation that President Biden signed into law in December. We're going to focus on this new law in a future podcast, but this is a broad accommodation policy for pregnant workers. In the first year of the SEP, this 2023, this issue will be a little bit unusual because the law does not actually go into effect until June. So until then, EEOC is going to process charges under the existing laws that apply, the ADA and the PDA. And even after the effective date, EEOC still has another 6 months to issue regulations. Again, it's also unusual for EEOC to even have the ability to issue regulations. So we'll see what's in those. A second newish issue, which was not on our radar screen 5 years ago, but certainly has been since 2020, and I think everybody knows what I'm going to talk about, is employment discrimination issues stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic, including long COVID. So this is still a focus, and they have added this to the new plan. Third emerging issue is technology-related employment discrimination, or AI, an issue near and dear to many of our hearts these days. It's mentioned throughout the SEP, and it's no surprise that the commission is planning to focus on AI tools in recruitment, screening, hiring, promotion, and employment decisions. And in fact, the commission is going to hold a lengthy commission hearing on that subject matter next week, which I understand will be the subject of our next podcast. Another bucket area that the EEOC has added to the draft plan is pay or advancing equal pay for all workers. And that's a pay equity bucket. In the draft plan, the commission signals its intent to use pay data to identify employers for pay equity cases, as well as charges that the commission can file on its own, which would be directed investigations, which the district offices can file under the Equal Pay Act, or commissioner charges, which they can file under other statutes. But to do so, Chair Burrows is going to need a majority of the commission to approve the new pay data collection rule. So Congress will need to confirm the Biden nominee for the fifth commissioner slot.
Hey, Leslie, before I let you go any further, I want to ask you about, you mentioned pay equity. That's obviously something we have really focused on very closely. I provided input on behalf of the Institute to the National Academy of Sciences. The NAS issued that 300 plus page report, detailed recommendations, and candidly, pretty critical of what the EEOC did before. Is part of the strategic plan include addressing and implementing what NAS has recommended?
That is not included in the strategic plan specifically, but I believe that the commission will certainly take that into account. They say they're taking it into account. We'll have to see how that goes.
And Leslie, I was wondering, is there anything that you saw in the plan that suggests whether the commission is likely to finally move on the harassment guidance that was initially proposed back during the Obama administration? You know, I know this has to be an area that you're very interested in because when you were on the commission, you led the EEOC's systemic task force that revamped the agency's program.
I think this talks more about the issues they're focusing on and not what they're going to pass. So think of this more as an issue document, but it certainly talks about harassment. And it talks about systemic harassment, but it's not just focused on sex. It's focused on harassment under all protected.
What are the key takeaways that employers really need to look at? It's got, as John said at the beginning, it is the kitchen sink. But what is the agency actually going to be able to implement this? Are we going to gain traction? Tell us what employers are going to see.
So this is only a draft policy, David. So you would think, oh, what's the big deal here? And in fact, the commission hasn't even voted on it. But here's the thing to keep in mind. The document really tells you everything you need to know about EEOC priorities. What charges they're likely to elevate if they hit the right issues. And that's because this document encapsulates all of Chair Barrow's priority issues. And at the end of the day, the EEOC chair's priorities are the agency's priorities, because the EEOC chair runs the entire enforcement part of the agency, from charge intake to investigation to conciliation. So beyond the ability to file a commissioner charge, to vote on a subpoena enforcement action, or to vote on this plan, EEOC commissioners have no actual authority and remarkably little influence on how the EEOC field offices prioritize charges and what they investigate. And not until it comes to litigation do they have any say.
That's fascinating. So really, Chair Burrows is going to be the key in what happens here. All right. Well, let's go from kind of one unusual event with a usual agency, EEOC, but this, as Leslie's explained, is once every 5 years, not like locust or something in the Old Testament, but this doesn't happen every day, to something that's at least that unusual. John, the FTC and this rule on non-competes, which really is quite shocking in its breadth and scope. What do we need to know on that?
Right, David. As you mentioned, the Fair Trade Commission, or FTC, they have really, with this proposed rule, made a move into regulating the workplace, which is, frankly, uncharted territory for this agency. Historically, the FTC has been focused on consumer protection issues and antitrust laws, which are typically aimed at preventing any competitive or deceptive business practices. But now they're effectively at least attempting to expand into an employee protection role. And just to take a step back before we get into too deep into why or how the FTC is doing this, I did just want to provide for any listeners who haven't read as deeply into what the proposed rule may have in it, what we're referencing here. On January 5th, the FTC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, which identified non-compete agreements as, quote, unfair methods of competition, and which the agency said are unlawful under the Federal Trade Commission Act. If enacted, this rule would essentially outlaw all non-compete agreements for workers in the United States. And in fact, the only exception that the proposed rule notes would relate to the sale of businesses, where a non-compete is being applied to a person selling a substantial portion of a business. I believe it's 25% or more. So, but outside of this really narrow exception, the use of any non-competes would be prohibited. And one more point before we move on, David, that I think is key here and that people will want to focus on is that this will be applied retroactively. So employers would be required to notify their workers that those agreements are no longer valid.
John, what prompted this? It was so surprising in some ways. So I'd love to know.
This didn't come completely out of the blue. In July of 2021, President Biden had issued an executive order titled Promoting Competition in the American Economy. And it actually directed the FTC to consider exercising its authority to curtail the unfair use of non-compete agreements, specifically when they unfairly limit worker mobility. Based on that, the FTC last year, at the end of 2022, issued a policy statement which clarified that at least the agency believed it had the authority under its governing statutes to extend into unfair conduct that tends to negatively affect the work conditions.
I thought this was an area the states were regulating. How would this impact the regulation?
That's absolutely right, Leslie. This is an area that has typically been left to the states. In fact, back in 2016, when President Obama had targeted non-competes in an effort to curtail them, he did so by urging the states to take action rather than using any sort of agency intervention. There had been some movement by the states on that front, but generally, states do permit non-compete agreements as long as they're not unreasonably restrictive and they're not used to do more than protect legitimate business interests. There are a few states that have put in place blanket bans similar to what the FTC is now proposing, California, North Dakota, and Oklahoma. A few other states in Washington, D.C. have put in place laws that only allow non-competes for people earning above a certain level. But the large majority of states treat these on a case-by-case basis, a fact-specific basis, and don't have any sort of blanket statute or rule that would prevent their use.
Well, of course, Fortney Scott is part of the Labor Advisory Committee to the Chamber of Commerce, and the chamber has made it very clear that they will be filing a lawsuit over this proposed rule.
That's right, Leslie. And just to be clear, the chamber is not the only one who has voiced some strong concerns about this proposed rule. Actually, a sitting FTC commissioner, Christine Wilson, issued a dissenting statement voicing her own concerns about the rule and the agency's authority to issue the rule. And the former Secretary of Labor, Eugene Scalia, wrote an op-ed similarly criticizing this effort by the agency to get this rule through. But ultimately, we do expect that we will see challenges once this rule is finalized, and that those challenges will have pretty good likelihood of success based on some recent decisions.
What do you see, John, just quickly? What would be sort of the key arguments that you can anticipate might be brought once this rule is finalized? Because I think it's likely to be finalized in or about the form that it's proposed in, which is a pretty comprehensive ban on non-competes.
I agree, David. And once it is finalized, I think the challenges can be summed up as the FTC is straying outside of its designated lane and it lacks the authority to act as an employment regulator. Specifically, you can be certain that any challenge will rely upon the Supreme Court's recent decision in West Virginia v. EPA that touched on the major question doctrine. Those challenges would argue that the FTC lacks that clear congressional authority for this proposed rule. And when you look at what was discussed by the Supreme Court there, they talk about agencies discovering new powers that they hadn't used before or going into areas where state law typically governs issues. It seems directly on point to the type of issues that we're dealing with here.
I would agree with you. I think that if I were betting, I'd bet on the successful challenge to the regulation, but I guess we'll have to see. We'll have to get the regulation out first, but it is pretty all-encompassing and a fundamental change. So that's the reason. Thank you, John, so much for helping highlight that for our listeners. Well, let me ask you, both Leslie and John, we're drawing towards the end of our allocated time, but I'd like to ask each of you, what are your final thoughts? What are the key takeaways that you would like our listeners to have? And Leslie, let's begin with you.
You know, we're dealing with two very different things here. I think the SEP, whether it's draft or finalized, is helpful. And employers, we should be helping our clients, and employers should be looking at themselves to see, do they have any issues that are ongoing that are within the SEP? Do they have charges coming up? Because those are the types of things that the commission could very much make a priority. Whereas the FTC is just a proposed rule. But because it is a proposed rule, and in order to challenge the rule, it's really important that employers and the employment community that opposes the rule gets in and makes comments on it.
I think those are both really, really great points. John, what's your final thought?
I think keeping an eye on these expected challenges to the FTC proposal, and depending on how those play out, if this final rule, once it is finalized, is upheld, I think we can expect the FTC to become, in some cases, the tip of the spear in addressing some workplace issues. Certainly, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have already raised some other areas that they would want the FTC to get involved in, including addressing the pay gap. So there's no end to the creativity on how they might be able to use those powers if the rule is upheld.
Well, I think that's right. And I think then that introduces the other lane. Of course, the reason you see these agencies, particularly the FTC, in this activist mode is because their existing legislation is more narrowly drawn. And there may be likely a pushback in Congress. There so often is that if you have a win in the courts, and the question is, well, okay, why doesn't Congress provide broader authority, say, for example, to the FTC to regulate all these broad workplace issues? Obviously, in the current 118th Congress, as we've previously discussed, that is not going to occur. There's a wildly divergent views and great political and policy divides. However, These are long-term plays. And this shift that we're seeing in reimagining what the agencies may or may not do will not only be litigated, but I think on top of that is likely to be addressed further by Congress in the future. All right. Lots of good information here. As always, I want to thank both Leslie and John for joining. It's been another terrific episode. And thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. We look forward to the next update. For those that would like to connect with any of the lawyers from Fortney Scott, please reach out to them directly by visiting fortneyscott.com. On the website, you can also listen to previous podcast episodes, as well as pick up your copy of the DC Insider Report and sign up for future updates. Thanks so much for listening.